like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is John Doe, co-founder of the legendary punk band X. He recently released another acclaimed solo album, The Westerner, and just published his first book, Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk, which interweaves Doe's accounts of the nascent Los Angeles punk scene with recollections of that time from such key figures of that scene as his ex-bandmate Exene Cervenka, Henry Rollins of Black Fag, Jane Whelan of the Go-Go's, and Dave Alvin of the Blasters. I'll talk about these projects and discuss horses and at least one horse organization when I speak with John Doe in just a moment here on Talking Animals. Before that, I'll play something from his new album, The Westerner. But first, I need to mention that the WMNF Fun Drive, Summer Fun Drive, starts 2 weeks from today, June 1st. Yikes! And on that day, I'll be looking to raise a great deal of money, probably around $3,000 in less than an hour. Yikes again! The only prospect I have of making that nutso goal is to raise some of that money before the Fun Drive show, so I'm hoping you'll pledge early. And right now isn't too soon, Frank. Perhaps I can entice you with Talking Animals exclusive thank you gifts, including amazing tickets to see Steely Dan and Steve Winwood in Tampa, copies of John Doe's new book, Big Black Sun, Pitbull, the remarkable new book by last week's guest Bronwyn Dickey, and signed by Dickey. Last week, her book was only out 4 days when it went into its third printing, plus other books, DVDs, and more. Feel free to email me at dj@wmnf.org during this show with questions, or it'd be great if you could give me a running start by donating via the Talking Animals tip jar, which you can find at wmnf.org. Go to the schedule and look for Talking Animals. Click on that, and then you'll be looking at the tip jar. Meanwhile, later today, incidentally, I'll be sitting in for Scott Elliott on the All Souls edition of It's the Music, 1 to 3:30 p.m. I hope you'll join me for that. Right now, though, before we speak with John Doe, let's hear some of his new music from The Westerner. This is John Doe with Get On Board on Talking Animals.
Gotta get on board this train. We gotta get on board this train. You might get the juice where you get on board, but we gotta get on.
We gotta get on board.
Let's get on board from the new album, The Westerner, by our guest today, John Doe. Let's get to it with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome John Doe back to Talking Albums. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thanks. Thank you very much for joining us again on Talking Animals. And boy, do we have a lot to talk about, very much including your new album, your new book, singing, signings, playings, all kinds of stuff.
Yep.
And we will discuss those things. I'm eager to do so. But by the charter of this show, I'm constitutionally obligated to start out talking about animals, and in this case, horses. So there are some wonderful photos with the booklet of your new CD, The Westerner, featuring you with or on a gorgeous host, and the booklet also mentions the website for Protect Mustangs. So let me start off by just saying, what do horses mean to you?
They mean that I don't think with the left side of my brain when I'm with them. And it's like therapeutic. And you have to pay attention. You have to be there, like right in the moment at the time, whatever you're doing, and be ready and be like in it. And I don't know if there's anything else that does that.
You mean anything else in your life that...
I think anything else in the world.
Wow, that's quite a...
I mean, it's kind of like meditation or yoga or any of those other things where you're just, you know, you hear everybody talking about being in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And with horses, that's what they require. That's how they operate.
Yeah.
And if you try to if you try to argue with that, you're going to probably make a mistake and not get the desired effect. So, but to back up a little bit, I got into horses maybe 30 years ago. So I didn't grow up with them or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But my friend Michael Blake, who's a writer, he got me into horses, and I've got a couple. My daughter and I ride quite a bit, and just, you know, nothing special, just trail riding.
Yeah.
Doing a lot of gentle horsemanship, you know, get them to think that this is a good idea rather than you making them do something. Much more of a partnership.
Yeah. Well, of course, we'll come back to Michael Blake in a moment, maybe more directly talking about The Westerner. But yeah, I remember when we spoke some years ago and talked a little bit about your daughters were, you know, obviously younger then, and just the importance of having animals on hand, and just talked then about just the importance of kids being brought up with animals, and just that the way that cultivates a sense of compassion and mm-hmm. empathy. And it sounds like for you and for adults, it's much more. And, you know, it's interesting, there's that one center photo in the CD booklet, and I actually posted that the other day on Facebook. And if someone didn't know any better, they would just think, well, this is a cool picture of a cool horse and a cool horse guy. Not necessarily, you know what I mean? That it didn't, you wouldn't think, hey, that's John Doe from X or with the new solo record or anything else. You just think, that's a horse guy.
Well, you know, like editing and presentation, you can fool anybody.
Well, no, but I just mean it makes sense that you're 30 years in with this, and that you feel so profound a connection that when you are with them, that it's just you and that horse. Because that, I mean, that,
you know,
photo.
It was a little bit like we were trying to recreate an old time photo of someone in their best suit with their most prized possession, or you know, they're with their partner.
Yeah.
And not possession, but you know, I'm wealthy in a lot of ways, and one way is being a partner with animals, and being a partner with these horses, and you know, we like each other, you know.
Yeah.
they kind of, when I get to the pasture, they may be 150 feet away, and they, you know, I call their name and they just come over because they know that it's going to be treats and it's going to be, you know, some messing around, and they can break up their card game for long enough to come out and hang out with me.
Are they playing poker in a velvet painting of some kind before you arrive? Or, yeah.
It's just a joke that we were, you know, it's like, oh, I got to get back to the pasture because the card game is...
Right, right. So, well, tell me about Protect Mustangs, because there aren't that many things noted on your CD jacket, but that's certainly one, so obviously it's important to you.
You know, I just wish that the BLM and the ranchers and everybody would just leave wild horses alone. I mean, they're doing all these programs like sterilization, which is kind of not really working. They're misreporting the number of horses that are out there, and they pretend that they're doing things to quote, protect them, and this organization, Protect Mustangs, is actually advocating. I do give money to sanctuaries, and that's all well and good, but really what Protect the Mustangs does is they advocate to keep them on the range, to do better reporting, to not to use that PZP stuff to try to sterilize them, because it doesn't really work very well. I want to advocate to keep them there, to have an accurate count, and not pretend that they're. I mean, there a lot of times it seems that the BLM is working to for the advantage of the ranchers, and I can understand that because they have worked together long for many generations. But this land is your land, this land is my land, and BLM land is actually our land, and I'd like to see Mustangs have a chance.
For sure. And we should just know for folks listening who may not be familiar, BLM is the Bureau of Land Management, and there's been an ongoing, and I mean, it's so ongoing, it's hard not to despair at times, struggle about the wild horses and burros and what the Bureau of Land Management thinks should happen to those Mustangs. And so there's always things you can do, and I think there's one or more petitions that help address that you can find at like change.org and other places. But
exactly.
Yeah. So, all right, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is John Doe, who has a new album out, The Westerner, and just published his first book, Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. If you'd like to ask John a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So let's talk about the book, Under the Big Black Sun, Personal History of L.A. Punk. Now, some of us more grizzled ex-John Doe fans have been sort of long figuring there'd be a John Doe book, but I at least did not anticipate this sort of book would constitute the first one. So to talk about how you decided that this was the first book out of the literary gate.
Out of the gate. My sweetheart and my co-author, Tom DeSavia, for maybe the last 3 years would encourage me and oftentimes harangue me into trying to write a book. And it sounded like way too much work and discipline that I wasn't really interested in. So I would say, oh, that's so sweet that you want me to do this, but thanks and no. And about 2 years ago, I had this flash of inspiration and thought, well, what if I got other people to help me do this? And then I wouldn't have to be the authority, and then I wouldn't have to do all the work, and I could be like Tom Sawyer in Painting the Fence. And everybody seemed to be excited by the prospect. I also don't really believe in an ultimate truth, and I wasn't interested in being the historian authority. So I act as kind of a narrator in the book. I have four, full chapters, like 3,000 to 5,000 words, and then a bunch of in-between pieces. And then people like Henry Rollins and Exene and Dave Alvin and Jane Wiedlin and Mike Watt from the Minutemen, and Jane Wiedlin, obviously, from the Go-Go's. And, they all have their stories, and Tom and I ended up giving them topics to concentrate on, things that we thought they were expert in.
Oh, was that true for each of the contributors? They all had kind of assignments, as it were?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Because, I mean, one of the things that I really noticed is how, and I guess focusing on the scene, this makes some sense, but there were so many threads throughout those contributions, and certain people or bands or things were just very much recurring. And again, inevitably Slash would be, but the Weirdos and the Germs and Darby Crash and some other things really were obviously just key experiences all these years later for most of those contributors, I would say.
Well, if there's one thing that ties the book together, which also has to do with the collaborative effect or the collaborative design of having other people write it, is there was a community. And it was, it was a great community of bohemians and misfits and screw-ups and just weirdos that somehow came together and made an artistic community. And that's compelling. And it continued into the way the book was constructed. So you get, I think, more context than the other books. Even though I like them, I like Please Kill Me, and We Got the Neutron Bomb. There's one from San Francisco called Give Me Something More, but they're all oral histories. So you, Duncan, are writing the book, and you call me up and say, hey, John, remember that crazy night where you fell down the stairs, and there was like some tough guys, and you got in a fight, and I say, oh, yeah, wow, that was crazy, and we blah, blah, and and then you transcribe it, and there's not a whole lot of fact-checking, and you don't get much context, like, what did the stairs look like? What did the building look like? Mm-hmm. What did it feel like in Los Angeles at the time? And that's what really comes, I hope, and I think comes through in the book, is that you get a sense of what it looked like, what it felt like, what, you know, the history of it was. And if somebody's writing a dedicated chapter, they've got to write it down, they've got to look at it, they've got to say, is this the story I want to tell, and is this the picture I want to paint, and am I going to get sued because I mentioned somebody's name?
Yeah.
And so we had to change some names. Yeah, we did.
But it's really interesting, giving the number of folks that contributed, was looking at the back of a book, probably a dozen or more off the top of my head. And some you would expect this based on their work then and subsequently. They're really wonderfully written to a person. But what's also really interesting is how much they are very, well, at least in the case I'm familiar with, very reflective of that person. Like Mike Watt, reading his piece is like listening to him talk, or one of his onstage spiels. I mean, it's just like you could be in the next room with him and just, you know, be hearing that stuff. So,
I love Mike Watt's Stream of Consciousness, where there are like 10 periods in the entire 6,000 words, and we had to edit it from 6,000. It was more like 10,000 words. And you know, half of those periods are like D period Boone.
Yeah. No, he's got a distinctive style. There's no question. What kind of surprises did you find when those things were first handed in to you guys?
I think I was surprised that everyone shared that view of community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought that there would be a lot more juicy kind of details of like, oh, I hated her and he was a jerk and this kind of thing. And maybe it's a little bit of the nostalgia creeping in, but it was totally gratifying that everyone had that same sense of community. And that's really the kernel of what binds it together and why people are still interested in it and the overall effect it's had.
And, you know, what's interesting, too, is, and obviously this is what you were going for, or partly so you didn't have to write the whole book yourself, I realized, when people were first, you know, hounding you to write a book.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's these multiple contributors, there is a sense of community and shared experiences and sort of pivotal moments and figures and bands. So, there is the overlap and the threads that I mentioned, but really, some of the people are very, I mean, Jack Grisham, I mean, for example, seems kind of grumpy and sour in writing his piece, like he just woke up on the wrong side of the keyboard, which I found interesting because I thought he and or you guys had a chance to edit that, and that's what he went with.
Oh,
and,
I loved it.
Yeah,
I loved
no, me
it.
Too.
I mean, there was an ongoing controversy about hardcore and the Hollywood scene, because the Hollywood scene started the thing, and it was very inclusive, and, you know, if you were gay or straight or brown or white or whatever, it's like, okay, you want to be part of this group that is going to be abused and shouted at from passing cars, you're welcome. Come
mm-hmm.
on in. It's fine. And then as hardcore came in, it became a little more codified, and because they were getting so much grief and being persecuted down in Orange County, and then it became testosterone-driven, and then women didn't feel like they were welcome, and whatever.
Yeah.
I just love the fact that that's there in Jack Grisham's writing, which is so lurid and, like, dripping and, you know, just full of bodily fluids and all this kind of stuff. But his main attitude is still the same, which is awesome. It's like, you started this, we finished it, what's your problem?
Yeah, yes. If you want to step outside, we can finish this conversation.
Yeah, stop your whining, which is kind of great. And
yeah.
But actually, in real life, he's a really sweet guy, and not as. But I love that.
Yeah.
That whole. I felt like a real score. I kind of patted myself on the back, like that was a good idea to include him, because now you have the, you know, a fuller picture.
Yeah, for sure. And then to read, like, you have little blurbs about the contributors, and to read, you know, I used to know him, and, you know, I lived in Orange County and wrote about music there for a long time. So, but to find out now that he lives in like a former schoolyard with five kids, Jack Grisham, you know, I mean, and the thing I just wrote even more so. But anyway, what's also cool is that each piece, as much as it totally hooks in and presents a real great composite, at least a lot of them are just great freestanding. Like Robert Lopez's is like a real, like, narrative arc, you know, sort of tracing the line from very sheltered teen in San Diego or thereabouts to something of an adult artist, and it's almost sort of cinematic the way he wrote his. And then Charlotte Caffey, and it's interesting how there's the, you know, implied and sometimes explicit thing about real sort of punk band bands and then Go-Go's and commercial success. But hers was a kind of this cool mini memoir of someone discovering and exercising their gift and just realizing, wow, I can write songs and collaborating with Jane Wedlin and just, you know, just sort of like you really like you felt like you're at that moment, her sense of discovery and like, wow, isn't this great? And hey, this verse works with what Jane came up with. And it's a real, it could be anybody, but just the idea of like recounting, like sort of finding that gift and realizing it and exploring it was pretty thrilling just in its own way. So.
Yeah, I'm glad that it comes through, that everybody has their own voice. And we felt pretty lucky, pretty fortunate that the people we chose were, you know, we would encourage them to be more specific or you know, just go with the way that they wanted to tell the story.
Yeah.
And each one has their own unique way of telling it. With Charlotte, her topic was songwriting.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Was how punk rock songs were written, and then I kind of chime in and and have my piece about, you know, how people wrote songs and why they wrote them the way they did. And you know, Elvez or Robert Lopez was the experience of someone there at the beginning who was the kind of person that the Ramones wanted to speak to. It was like teenagers. They were going to freaking high school, and then on the weekends they'd play punk rock shows.
Yeah, well, again, without knowing about the topics or the assignments, and it makes more sense because I guess the risk otherwise would have been too much direct overlap from piece to piece.
Well, but there is some great overlap. Like everybody had a bad time in high school.
Right.
Everybody loved David Bowie.
Yeah.
Everybody, you know, felt like a misfit until they found some other people that were, you know, had the same experience.
And a lot of people were transplants from elsewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, in one of your pieces, or a few pieces, really get much more of a sense of your story, and you're a roofer, and you're going to college, and you make it clear you're really on a quest. You know, even note that you know, had a desire for fame and success, and this was sort of fueling your move and your initial adventures out in L.A. But there's some real stark scenes, A Lonely Christmas, and some shows on the road that would have to go up a few notches to reach the level of Hell Gig and stuff, but just that was part of, you know, getting a band going and you know, the learning curve and the chops and everything else. And
it wasn't being a virtuoso wasn't a requirement. It was all playing from your gut, playing from your crotch, without being a D-bag. So,
yeah, but it was interesting too, along those lines, that Billy Zoom was also clear at one or more points that his being adamantly opposed to certain styles of music kept X kind of forceful and focused, and maybe from sort of blunting the force and intensity of X music by wandering off this direction. He just wouldn't have any part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's very convinced that this is the right thing.
Well, hard to argue at this point.
God bless him.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is John Doe from the band X, who just published his first book, Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk, and has a new album out, The Westerner. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org. Or text 813-433-0885. As if the book isn't enough, you did just release this new album, The Westerner. And as one way to move from the book, discussing the book, to the record, is that sort of ghosts hover over both to a certain extent. Does that?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. On the new album, and we already mentioned it, but let's maybe get into it more. There's at least one ghost or presence, and that's Michael Blake. For those listening who may not be familiar with Michael Blake, can you describe him a bit?
He was from New Mexico, and his greatest achievement was writing Dances with Wolves, which he got an Oscar at the Academy Awards. And he wrote several other books. He wrote a sequel to Dances with Wolves called The Holy Road, and also a great book called Marching to Valhalla, which is an account of Custer going to the Little Bighorn, but it's from Custer's perspective. And it kind of gives, it's a bit of a history, but it's also based on what Michael thought George Custer's diary would be. And he felt like in this book, George Custer is going to his greatest achievement as he goes to the Little Bighorn, because he's so delusional and arrogant that he thinks, like, I'm going to show these guys, like, who's the freaking boss here. Show them, like, what strategy is all about. And
Boy, do you have another thing coming, sir. Yeah.
That way. But Michael's a great friend of mine. He was like an older brother. And like I said before, he introduced me to horses. He'd been a horseman all his life. And I will always be grateful to him for that. And he had Alzheimer's or dementia. And so I wanted to be close to him. He lived in Tucson. My friend Hal Gelb also lives down there and works out of this studio called Wave Lab. And so started working with Hal, and so I could be close to my friend Michael, and that's how the record began.
Yeah. So really it was wanting the time with and that Hal Gelb was there, rather than saying, hey, there's something in the desert for me or some sort of new possible form of inspiration that I want to explore. That was sort of the byproduct of having gone there.
It was both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like most things, one feeds the other.
Yeah.
But the songs that I was writing in the last 3 or 4 years, I started seeing a thread that I wanted to exaggerate or to go with, which was using my friend as a character in some of the songs, mm-hmm. or writing directly about his life. That song Sunlight is about his life. The song Sweet Reward could be, but it was just kind of came out all at once. And then I realized that they could be brought to life better with some help from someone who's like Hal's work that I really admire. And people who aren't familiar with his stuff, he's had a long career with a band called Giant Sand, and they have this a lot of space and a lot of linear things like the desert. The way it sounds is the way it looks.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the oral equivalent.
Yeah, and other bands that people might be familiar with are Calexico, because both Joey Burns and John Convertino were in Giant Sand, and then they broke off to do Calexico. Nico Case worked with Hal and worked down in Tucson for a long time, so her sound is very similar to her earlier stuff is similar to the way Hal produces and records. And I just figured, what the hell? You know, this is all pointing in one direction, so go for it. It turned out.
And do you think, John, that, I mean, obviously being there and being with Howie and, you know, the kind of sound that he gets certainly obviously shaped the audio side of the Westerner, but was it really the thread and thinking about Michael? Because to me, it's just the songwriting is so, I mean, you know, there's the sort of classic cliched thing of, you know, artists with a sizable body of work, and there's an interview, and at some point the artist says, I think this is my new record or book or movie or whatever is my best work. And to me, I like to sort of flip this around and say, to me, this does really represent, I think, some of your very best work. So I'm just wondering if that was, just on the songwriting side, just because of that further impetus from Michael and thinking about Michael and having those threads run through those songs.
Oh, sure.
Okay.
It's great to have a point that you're driving towards,
mm-hmm.
you know? And if you can focus things, if you have that, then if you have a decision to make, and you say, "Oh, right, I'm going towards this point, and this is the point that I'd like to make," and so you have something that's over an umbrella, something that's overriding,
mm-hmm.
or leading
Unified.
Towards one thing, and,
yeah.
and the way that Hal records, and the way that the desert is you're really into the space, and we made a conscious effort not to have too much stuff on there, not too many instruments and not too much overdubs and things like that. So, but if you have a central character in any kind of a piece, then,
mm-hmm.
you know, which some of it is just me and I'm pretending that it's somebody else.
Sure.
But that's what people do. And,
yeah.
But if you have that central character, then you can kind of tailor things towards that. And as the songwriting went on, then you fill in the gaps. I guess I should think about writing a slower song, or I should write a faster song or whatever.
Yeah, and again, it's in a lean kind of backdrop to begin with, so everything kind of is given more
mm-hmm.
more weight. Yeah. So between the Westerner and the new book, I've been thinking a lot about writing and what it takes to achieve and sustain excellence. You know, in the stand-up world where I you know, spend some time and have some knowledge, the rule of thumb is that it takes about 10 years to get good. And part of that calculus is performing, dealing with bad nights, hellish crowds, whatever. You know, as well as the writing that happens along the way. Songwriting doesn't require that live element necessarily, but at this point I'd be interested to know what you think about how long it takes, and or more to the point, what it takes to to get good at songwriting beyond just keep doing it, but is there so, is there something else that that figures into that? You can pass and go on to the next round if you like. So yeah.
I'm sorry, Mr. Doe. Your time has expired. I think it's that is a rough one. There, as I go on, I write songs together in a clump. I'll write two or three songs at the same time, and as I think I'm going to finish one, I'll actually finish another. And I also have found that it's easier to do it at the same time, to write the melody and the words along with the chord changes, whereas before I would do it more piecemeal.
Mm-hmm.
And but there's a point at which you're writing songs like somebody else, and then you're writing songs like another person, and then suddenly you realize, oh, this actually is different, and this is something that I wrote instead of trying to write like somebody. And once you realize that, then you're kind of on your way. And to keep it simple, to not. You know, it's that same thing that I was talking about with working with horses. If you're trying to be logical with horses, you'll get screwed, and you'll be a bad horseman. The whole idea of natural horsemanship is that you're thinking like a horse. You're thinking with the right side of your brain. You're just being in the moment. And if you can use that intuitive sense in songwriting, then you're not being a brainiac. And I don't really like brainiac anything. So
a lot of it's just, it is the time, it is the experience, it is the craft, but it's also as part of that knowing how and when to get out of your own way.
Yeah, and just being real and being honest. You know, you can be tricky and you should be clever, but that can be in the editing phase. You know, I'm a big fan of changing the small words, like from and to but, or if and with, and things like that. I think those connectors are pretty key.
In terms of how a line connects to a line, or an idea in a song
and
connects?
The meaning of it, and it's, you know, the fine-tuning it is kind of fun. You don't want to get stymied by editing things. You got to move on to the next, the next piece. But that's cool.
Yeah, so it's as with other disciplines, it's as much sometimes the rewriting and editing that makes that song
makes it more concise and economical and stuff like that.
Yeah, although one thing that really back to the book for a moment, really seemed like because you had done writing and played and stuff even before you moved to LA, that you guys, and then again, this comes through in a lot of the accounts of your contributors in the book, that you guys, I mean, relatively speaking, arrived, X did, fairly fully formed when it came to making the first record, for example.
Yeah, but that was 3 years into our existence. We started in 77, and our first record didn't come out until 1980.
Yeah.
And I think that was important to any music scene. That's why the Seattle scene was so good. And maybe the second or third wave of New York scene suffered. I think of the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and the Strokes and those bands. If they had been left alone and not gotten quite so popular quite so fast, they might have found something that was a little more lasting.
And
I'm not putting them down because I think they're good.
Right. But
we got left alone because nobody gave a crap.
Right.
You know, they're weird. And I don't like that because I don't understand it. Whereas we thought, you know, you were talking about ambition before. We thought, well, we're just going to be the next version, you know, and so did Dick Clark from American Bandstand, for God's sake. You know, he thought, he asked Kexeen one time, says, what's the deal? You know, I thought like punk rock is going to be the next thing. What happened? And Kexeen's thinking, you're Dick Clark. You should be telling me what happened.
That's so funny. Yeah. And as a side note, I found it interesting that Rachel Maddow had Dick Clark clip of X the other night. Yeah.
She's cool.
Yeah.
She's smart.
Yeah. So, you know, this all this thing in some ways, now that we're back on X a little bit, and I asked you this a number of years ago, and you shut me down quickly, of course, in a totally charming way. But can you see a point at which there might be some new X music? Or is that sort of just not the way anybody's thinking these days and operating these days?
I think it's pretty unlikely.
Yeah, just because
we do have some great live stuff from Pearl Jam tours that we did few years ago. So we might release that.
Okay. Because just like even on your record, there's an Axine song and something, even Axine, you know, it's just, I don't know. I guess there's probably some people who just think, well, they're still touring. They're still great. They're still.
What's the deal? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know what the deal is.
Okay. Well, that's sort of, that's Dick Clark's department, I think, but he's not here to really conduct that. So we're sort of in our final moments. We're speaking with John Doe, of course, from X, the aforementioned X, and the new CD that he has is called The Westerner, and there's a new book out, his first book called Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk. I guess in light of yesterday's news, I'd like to know, what did Guy Clark mean to you?
You know, I have to admit, I didn't really follow his career, and I should have.
Okay.
Don't be mad at me.
No.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You can only do so much.
Right, right. There's a lot of people to...
Merle Haggard's passing meant a lot to me. That was rough.
Yeah.
You know, we all got to go sometime, so... both those guys had a great impact, and you know, they're pretty fortunate to be as well known and received as they were, and have all the, I mean,
yeah.
Have all the stuff that they did.
For sure. Yeah, no, 2016, man, this has been a rough one for some real real significant losses. So now I know you're doing a book tour and readings and playing some. Of course, I do notice that none of those things involve you stepping across the Florida state line. Anything we can do to cajole you into that?
It's all time and money, Duncan.
Okay, all right.
So tell your promoters, tell the clubs down your way to call up my booking agent and say, there's a small bank account down here that has John Doe's name on it.
Okay.
I'll be there in a flash, man.
All right. Well, that's it. Maybe WNF, you know, we do concerts here. Maybe we need to bring on.
Sure.
Looks like we have a caller here that, let me at least try on the fly here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with John Doe?
Hello.
Oh, okay. That was a canned call. I thought it might be based on the line it rang on. So, okay. Well, John, thank you so much once again for joining us on Talking Animals. This has been, of course, John Doe. One more time, the new CD is The Westerner. The new book is Under the Big Black Sun, A Personal History of L.A. Punk, wherever you get your books. And his website is johndoe.com. And all new, fancy, and revamped, and all kinds of cool info and projects and dates and everything is right there. So,
well, thanks, Duncan.
Thanks again.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Keep talking to those animals. They'll tell you beautiful, wonderful, magical things.
That's what they keep doing. So cool. And they sound like they're doing the same. At least the horses are doing the same for you. So
absolutely.
Cool, man. Thanks, John.
All right, buddy. See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
It's time to step into the comedy corner. Kevin Hart is clearly the biggest act in stand-up right now. He doesn't just play arenas. He sometimes plays stadiums. He's also done a lot of animal material over the years, like this piece. It's a portion of a piece called Phobias by Kevin Hart in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
I don't like dolphins. I'm scared of dolphins. I am. Me and my wife, we was in Maui, right? We in Maui. She's like, come on, babe. We should go swim with the dolphins. I was like, nah. I told you how I feel about them dolphins. She's like, come on, stop being a bitch. Let's just do it. I was like, don't call me no bitch. She's like, bitch? Man, whatever. Like, you know, we don't got to come back, so you just got to, you stupid. That's all I had. I didn't have nothing else to say. So we go, we get there. They got the dolphins in this tank. It's like 8 dolphins in this tank, right? When I get there, I see this old lady on the back of a dolphin. I see this little boy. I'm like, you know what, babe? I might have been overreacting. Get the camera, take some pictures of me on the back of the dolphin. I was hyped, right? I get in the water. I'm on the back of the dolphin. The instructor, he's like, as soon as you grab the dolphin fin, the dolphin gonna start taking you around. So whenever you're ready, grab his fin. I was like, all right, cool. I'm ready. As soon as I grabbed my dolphin fin, my dolphin went straight to the bottom of the tank. Like, he just went down. So because I was scared, I didn't let go. I held on. Like, you know when you're scared, how you start to mentally create in your own mind? I was like, okay, it's obvious that I got a racist dolphin. He don't like black people. He done cut a deal with a shark, bring him a black piece of meat. Something bad about to happen, right? So I let go. I get to the top. When I let go, I'm so scared, I start snapping on the instructor as soon as I see him. I was like, nobody saw dolphin number 8 missing? Y'all didn't notice I was going for like 30 seconds? He tried to kill me! He tried to kill me! I was mad, yo. I was fucking scared. I was like, y'all see the old lady and a little boy, but nobody saw the black swirl missing? Huh? Nobody noticed that the black dot wasn't going around? Y'all didn't notice that? He's like, calm down, man. Calm down. It's 3 feet. Just stand up. I was like, what? What'd he say? I didn't even realize that I was walking and talking shit. At the same time, Come to find out, I never even went underwater. What happened was some water splashed in my face. And I panicked. I made it up. I made it all up. I was scared.
That was Kevin Hart with a portion of a piece called Phobias, taken from his album, I'm a Grown Little Man. Come up at 11 on WMNF. It's Rob Loroy and Radioactivity rolling into the noon hour. Constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more with contributions from members of the stellar WMNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, as a prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, it's time for some animal news and some rough news lately in animal news and the What Are People Thinking division. For example, kind of locally here, Newport Richey, Joe the dog, thrown from a moving minivan in Newport Richey, died during surgery on Monday. Francis Veterinary Hospital in Spring Hill said Joe did not survive a surgery to fix his diaphragm. Quote, we would like to thank the community for the outpouring of support we have seen over this past weekend. Heaven has gained another angel, the hospital said in a statement. When Joe was thrown from the minivan, his organs were pushed into his abdominal cavity and the diaphragm and pelvis broke. Deputies are searching for the suspect who allegedly threw Joe from the moving van. If you have any information about this case, by the way, please call the Sheriff's Office tip line at 800-706-2488. That's 800-706-2488. And then, of course, there's the bison calf, Yellowstone. Animal and nature lovers learned a hard lesson this week after a bison calf had to be euthanized at Yellowstone National Park. The bison's death came after some well-intentioned but misguided visitors found it about 2 miles east of the historic Lamar Buffalo Ranch in Wyoming. They put it in their SUV and took it to rangers, fearing it was too cold for the bison. They were cited for their actions because handling wildlife is strictly against regulations, Yellowstone exhibit specialist Joe Sudeman said. It didn't help the calf. Park rangers repeatedly tried to reunite it with its herd, but it was rejected, and it had become a hazard as it continued to approach people and cars, and so they made the decision to euthanize it. And one thing, at least not on a dark note, found Sunday's New York Times. Discovery of artifacts shows humans and mastodons coexisted in Florida. It starts off as a piece by James Gorman. Florida, it seems, has always been a popular destination. Even the first known Americans gravitated to the state. Of course, they probably went for the mastodon. Underwater archaeologists and other researchers have taken a second look at a sinkhole 30 feet deep in the Ocotillo River in northern Florida that is rich with remnants of stone tools as well as fossilized mastodon bones and dung. The scientists had studied the location known as the Page-Ladson site for more than a decade and knew how old some of the material was. They could not come up with definitive evidence that humans and mastodons were there at the same time. Now, the researchers say, the discovery of an unmistakable human artifact, a stone knife fragment embedded in sand and dung that allowed for exact dating, proves that Paludonians, as archaeologists call the first people to come to North America, colonized northern Florida by 14,550 years ago. So, who'd have thunk? It's our news for today. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're all listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days, and there'll be a prize, a Talking Animals t-shirt. The first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song, selected, of course, with John Doe in mind. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune? That is the question. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WNF Tampa. Rob Loroy is up next with what amounts to 2 hours of radioactivity. I'll be back next Wednesday, May 25th, with another edition of the show. Again, 2 weeks from today, we start the summer membership drive. I hope you'll consider going to WNF.org, finding Talking Animals on the schedule, and slip a few bucks in our tip jar. If you like what we do here, like the interviews, John Doe Today, Bronwyn Dickey with the amazing Pitbull book, the week before, and so on. Give us a head start on this crazy goal that we'll be facing. Really appreciate it. You know, again, we have all kinds of amazing exclusive thank you gifts if you're inclined in that direction. So I also hope you visit TalkingAnimals.net, where you can find audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are there, too. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook. Like the show, but really, if you could friend me, too, seems to work better. Talking Animals page, those scoundrels at Facebook to get any kind of wide reading, you got to pay, right? You got to pay to boost the post. We can't do that. Anyway, you can also subscribe to our email newsletter at TalkingAnimals.net to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animals world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Trust. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. We're going to be closing out today's show, as we often do, with an animal song. This one by Laura Veers, Little Lapdog Lullaby, on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Largo, Weeki Wachee and Beyond, Community Conscious Radio. I'll catch up with you later today, 1 o'clock, filling in for Scott Elliott on It's the Music, and be back next Wednesday morning at 10 a.m. for more Talking Animals. Actually, we're going to hold off on the Laura Veers song. We'll hear it maybe next week. But thanks very much for listening. This is WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10, and much sooner, later today, 1 p.m., taking a crack at a music show, filling in for Scott on It's the Music. Thanks so much for everything. Take care.